detected at specific times, at which point we'll capture or eliminate them. Then we, by which I mean Shamunar, will take the observation zone they would have been covering. We'll plug the hole their absence leaves.
Understood. But, sir, I know many of these officers very well. They're not traitors.
I'm sure the ones you personally vouch for are completely loyal. When you give me the list of officers, be sure to indicate which ones you're certain of.
Kloskin leaned forward to give Bjork a sympathetic clap on the shoulder.
I know this comes as a shock, son, but we'll get it straightened out very quietly, and it won't reflect on your service record.
Thank you, sir.
Druwa, Moon of Almania.
Ben spent the better part of 2 days planning his trip to Xyost. In that time, he performed his credit card stealing technique twice more, and was pleased to discover that it became easier, smoother, and less detectable each time. He did do some planetary database research to find out whether any shuttle carrier or excursion service made trips to Xyost. The answer was a definite, unequivocal no, since Xyost did not appear in any public database. Still, its coordinates were in the files Jason had given him. Nor was there, as far as he could determine, much smuggling activity here. There was nothing to suggest that desperate ship owners, as his Uncle Han had been so many years ago, lurked in every tavern, willing to take aspiring young Jedi wherever they needed to go. Well then, he'd just have to steal a vehicle. Security around the spaceport was not exactly lax, but neither was it set up to deter a Jedi. It didn't take him too long to find the craft he thought best suited to carry him to Xyost. It was an old Y-wing starfighter, carefully maintained, its hull paint unscarred.
Corellian System Exclusion Zone, aboard the Errant Venture.
In the first few days after Errant Venture was authorized to ply its trade for Alliance military personnel in the Corellian system, its casinos and other entertainments did great business. Booster Tarek, the grand old man of the operation, though he was theoretically retired from day-to-day duties, was often seen in the casinos, flitting around in his hover chair, greeting patrons and encouraging workers, his eyes alight in the way that only commerce could make them. His new unpaid workers didn't hurt things either. Ayella and Miri worked as dealers. Ayella wore enough makeup to disguise her true identity. Miri did not need that precaution, but did change her hair color with spray-on hues and combinations each day, just because it was her custom. Two attractive women, a generation apart, skillful conversationalists and card handlers, they drew good-sized crowds at their tables each day, and their tips were grand enough to make Miri wonder whether intelligence was the career she wanted for herself after all. Lando and Han worked the casinos too, but not as dealers. Each day they set up in different casinos, at sabacc tables. Lando maintained his Biscott of Derman identity, and Han continued to put on his yellow-skinned, thin mustache makeup each morning. At the end of each day, they compared their winnings. After the first week, Lando was slightly ahead. Mirak spent most of her time with her father. During years of retirement on Corellia, she had cheerfully ignored her father's efforts to bring her to the Errant Venture to learn and perhaps take over its operations. Now, her homeworld was for the time hostile to her, and she had nothing to do more suited to her talents. So she threw herself into these new studies with typical Mirax obsessiveness, delighting her father. Leia, Wedge, and Corrin concentrated on the data interpretation side of things, seldom venturing into the ship's public areas. Each such trip, however short, would cause them to have to don disguises. They confined themselves to an auxiliary computer cabin provided by Booster and began meticulously assembling and analyzing the data the others provided them. Data came from the drunk patrons and the sober ones, from the happy ones and bitter ones, from the officers with marital problems and straying eyes, from the personnel with accumulated resentments and inadequate filters between their brains and their mouths. The most valuable data often came from patrons who, at the end of their rest and recreation leaves, were dead broke and too drunk to stand. The special circle of Errant Venture employees took care of them, letting them sober up in quiet little lounges, giving them enough credits for a return shuttle flight to their military units, assuming they had bought round-trip fare in the first place, which often they hadn't, and even half carrying them to the shuttle docks for their outbound flights. Han, Lando, and the other data gatherers became new best friends to an immense number of young soldiers, pilots, and technical personnel. But the information they farmed was frustratingly tenuous. 1 week into their operation, the data gatherers assembled to see if there were any informational gemstones to be found. "I know this is going to sound strange," Leia said, "but I haven't found any indication that this war was precipitated by outside forces. I've been reviewing news reports, historical analysis, all the data we have on hand, and it looks like the central conflict between Corellia and the GA was the inevitable conclusion of their respective political directions."
"Fewer syllables, please," Lando said. "Remember, your husband is at the table."
Han gave him a faintly amused "you're next" look, then turned his attention back to his wife.
"So that means no puppet master?"
She shook her head. "It means that the war itself is not the puppet master's original plan, or at least not his fault. But the manipulations we think we've detected do add up to something. We can see a cause and effect relationship. We just have to figure out the motive."
Aiella opened up her datapad.
"Events like the Corellian ambush of the GA fleet that came in to intimidate it. The outcome? Corellia remained independent a while longer. If it hadn't, another world would probably have become the focal point of the independence movement. Bothawi or Kaminor would be likely candidates. But Corellia had something they didn't."
Wedge nodded.
"Centerpoint Station. And a secret assault fleet."
"Correct," Aiella said. "Then we have Admiral Kloskin, who pretty clearly was meddled with, if we're right that these Force Ghost manifestations are evidence of our puppet master. The result of that interference? The situation here was worsened. The Alliance was cast in a bad light. Corellia received a lot of sympathy. Speeding up the process by which other worlds considered coming in on Corellia's side," Leia said. "Then the whole thing at Toriath Station, the death of Prime Minister Saxon, it caused a change in Corellian leadership, permitting Thrakken Sal Solo to boost himself from Minister of War to President. And with war preparations accelerating, he had to put his secret fleet on the resources list." Her voice quiet, as though she was hesitant to speak up in this exalted company. Miri said,
"It also scattered the Jedi."
Leia frowned.
"What?"
Miri looked uncomfortable.
"Well, it didn't scatter the Jedi, really. I mean, the Jedi Council on Coruscant wasn't affected. But if you look at family ties, which have made so much of a difference over the years with a Solo Skywalker extended family, one minute you were all together, and then, boom, you were scattered across the galaxy. Some of you at odds. It was like a secret grenade."
Leia and Han exchanged a suspicious look, and Aiella regarded her daughter with interest.
"That's an interesting interpretation," Leia said. Her tone suggested caution, reserve. "I hadn't considered that as a factor."
Miri, her idea not having been shot down by the accumulated aces, began to look more comfortable.
"At school, we were taught the follow the principle. Follow the money, follow the lover, follow the resources. The trick is sometimes in identifying the resources."
Corrin had been nodding ever since the first follow the left Miri's lips.
"You're saying the Solo Skywalker clan is a significant resource, and that it has been eliminated?"
"Yes."
Leia wasn't able to keep a little anger out of her voice.
"We have not been eliminated."
"Not as individuals, no."
Corrin gave her a sympathetic look, but didn't yield.
"But as a family, tell me that you can send out a call, as you could have done 6 months ago, and focus the attention and skills of your entire family on a single problem or enemy. Tell me that."
Leia thought about it, then seemed to wilt just a little.
"I can't."
Dozens of decks below, a small cargo craft rose in the main hangar bay of the Errant Venture. It wasn't a pretty vehicle. About 40 meters in length from bow to stern, it had a front end, its main cargo hull that was as elegant and aerodynamic as a thick Nerf stake cut into a rectangle and stood up on its edge. Behind that, constituting about a third of the length of the craft, was the maneuvering shaft, a low cylinder housing the main thrusters and the servos that position the maneuvering fins, long wing-like surfaces that stretched laterally from the shaft. In short, it looked like the mutant offspring of a bird and a brick, re-engineered by Verpines to fly backward. This example of the YV-666 line had dents, blast scars, and rust patches all over its hull, making it especially unlovely. At the forward portion of the top deck, Captain Uran Levint carefully maneuvered the awkward craft up into the hangar, then followed the glowing spherical droid above a trail of blinking lights on the hangar floor to her assigned berth.
"Soon as we land," she said, "you'll want to get into the smuggling compartment. They'll do a basic scan from outside."
"We understand."
Alima's voice came from a patch of shadow, impenetrable by ordinary sight at the back of the bridge.
"Why do they care if they're undeclared passengers?"
"It's all money."
Levin set the craft down with only the faintest of thumps, though that noise was joined by the squeal and creak of Durasteel components settling. She grimaced at the noise.
"If they don't know about you, they can't charge you for, well, anything. Soon as I get my cabin assignment, I'll calm you where it is."
Coruscant, Jedi Temple.
Mara leaned forward, elbows on the table on either side of the datapad retrieved from Lumaya's abandoned quarters, and rested her chin in her hands. Weeks earlier, meticulous police work tracking from the site of the murder of Jedi Master Trasina Lobi had led to an apartment in the Zorp House apartment tower, and the realization that the Sith Lady Lumaya was one of the murderers. An encrypted data card was the only clue Lumaya had left behind. From the other side of the table, Luke looked at her.
"You cracked the encryption on the data card?"
"Finally."
"But you don't look happy."
"You don't need a force bond to tell that, farm boy."
"Tell me."
"Some of it's an invoice. The sender seems to have been a bounty hunter working for Lumaya, and the invoice is an itemized list of expenses. Hours worked, fuel expended, blaster shots taken. The main part, though, is a mission status, an event report. Even decrypted, it's hard to puzzle out. Everything is referred to by code words. But assuming I'm putting the right names to some of these code words, the information is interesting."
"Such as?"
"Confirmed that the lady's daughter succumbed to injuries inflicted by grandson 32707,
Mara recited.
"Please inform if lady's mission changed from insertion observation to revenge."
Luke frowned over that one. Lady has to be Lumaya. She used to style herself the Dark Lady of the Sith, after Emperor Palpatine and my father were no longer around to slap her down for presumption.
"I agree. And if that same time context is the basis for more than one of these code names, grandson would therefore have to be one of Darth Vader's grandsons, right? Jason or Ben."
32707, Luke said.
"Just a second."
He pulled out his datapad, connected it remotely to the temple's computer, and went searching for a report Ben had filed weeks earlier.
"Here it is. BMX-32707, an uninhabited star system near Bamil. That's where the woman Sayo led Jason and Ben, where Jason defeated some sort of dark side force user within the asteroid under her habitat."
"Where Nalani Din died?"
Mara looked confused.
"Nalani was Lumaya's daughter?"
"No. Nalani's parents have files in the Order database, and Nalani looked a lot like her mother. Besides, Nalani died the same day Jason and Ben arrived at the habitat. Your file there suggests that the lady's daughter lingered for a while." Luke frowned.
"The other woman who was there, Brisha Sayo. Brisha could be an anagram for Shira B. Shira Bree. Lumaya's real name."
Luke nodded.
"I didn't make the connection at the time, because then it had been years since we'd heard anything about Lumaya."
A thought was growing within him, and alongside it, a worry, a big one. "Let's say Lumaya has a daughter. She names her Brisha, a self-tribute, and Brisha works with her. Brisha lures Jason and Ben to an ambush. She and the mysterious Sith she claims is living in her basement. Maybe he's just a dark Jedi she's hired. Maybe he's Lumaya's Sith apprentice. Are going to kill Ben, an act of revenge for everything I've done to Lumaya. Or maybe to capture him, train him to be a Sith, which is just as much revenge and twice the evil."
"I did a thing or two to her as well."
"Right. Revenge against both of us. But Nalani is there too, and throws the odds off. The Darksider and Nalani are killed. Brisha is badly wounded, Ben gets a knock in the head and forgets what happened, and Jason presumably never figures out that Brisha was one of the bad guys. Jason and Ben leave, and weeks later, Brisha succumbs to injuries."
"And her mother..."
Mara winced.
"Her mother would want revenge. against Jason. He's racking up quite a body count against daughters of dangerous opponents of ours.
Luke shook his head. We don't know that Jason wounded Brisha. How could he have done so and then left the habitat without thinking of her as an enemy? Ben must have done it, during one of the periods of time his memory doesn't cover, which would make Ben the target. His stomach began doing flip-flops. In addition to being a cocky teenager alone in a galaxy at war, Ben might now be the target of one of the galaxy's deadliest killers, a woman who had fought Luke to a standstill mere weeks before.
Your theory spooks me, farm boy, because it answers a lot of the questions we've been asking. Why Lumaya would have infiltrated the Galactic Alliance Guard to gather information about Jason or Ben and prepare for revenge if she needed to take it. Why she would have been around for so long as we've known she has been but didn't attack you until a few weeks ago. Because that's when she received word about her daughter dying.
Her frown deepened.
And what if this is the reason for all Jason's bad decisions? What if Brisha or the Sith apprentice on that planetoid got to him, affected him, infected him in some way?
Then whatever's afflicting him might be easily curable. Mara slammed her fist down on the tabletop and turned away from Luke. Far from being pleased by that possibility, she'd been angered by it. And even without the benefit of their force bond, Luke thought he knew why. Because if Jason were the victim of some Sith brainwashing technique, he wasn't responsible for his recent actions. In which case, Mara couldn't forge and sharpen her emotions. Her dedication to oppose and eliminate him, as a former Emperor's hand, should be able to.
We have to find out what happened on that asteroid, Luke said. And we have to confront Jason face to face to do that. We can't be in a position where all he has to do is press an off switch to shut us out.
I agree.
Mara's voice was strained.
Corellian Exclusion Zone, aboard the Errant Venture.
The universe was not cooperating, and Alima Rar was becoming impatient with it. There was a Jedi other than herself aboard Errant Venture. She was sure of it. As she stalked the darkened passageways and shadow-filled casinos, as she wandered, wrapped in robes that concealed her disfigurement, enough to allow her to mingle with drunken gamblers and revelers, she would occasionally feel little pulses and eddies in the Force that were characteristic of Jedi presence. But she never spotted the Jedi. To the logic she employed in her calculations, that meant one thing. The Jedi was hiding. Hiding from her. And therefore, it was Leia. That evening, in the cabin she surreptitiously shared with Captain Levint, she spoke of these matters.
You are almost free of your debt to us, she said. You have brought us to where the Solos, at least Leia, conceal themselves. But we cannot find her, them. When we see them, then you are free.
Bothoe System, aboard the Shamunar.
On the records and assignment sheets, a thin screen of starfighters and armored shuttles equipped with long-range sensors guarded the rimward edge of the star system. If the fleets that were assembling, performing maneuvers and war games, and otherwise rattling their lasers deep within the system, were to head out in a direction of the outer rim, towards, say, Kamino, directly opposite the direction a fleet would most logically take if headed toward Corellia, this screen would detect it and transmit that information to Shamunar for retransmission to the Second Fleet. The Bothans would not be able to take the task force at Corellia by surprise, in theory. In fact, Admiral Kloskin had identified a number of this task force's pilots and officers as traitors. He'd been very careful to flag the ones whom Captain Bjork had already written up for various disciplinary reasons, and to avoid those Bjork indicated he trusted implicitly. Then Kloskin had assigned each of them to the outer rim screen. He and Bjork had positioned Shamunar at the heart of the coverage area, and had called in each one of those on-duty pilots in turn, arresting them and seizing their vehicles. Now, though they were still officially on station, each of the alleged traitors was in the brig, and Shamunar floated alone, doing the work of the entire screen by herself. She was more than able for the job, of course. She had been fitted with the best long-range sensor suites a frigate could boast. It was unfortunate that she couldn't remain at her usual station, well outside the Bothoe system, on the Bothoe-Corellia approach corridor. But there, she was merely redundant. Here, she was doing critical work.
Don't worry, Kloskin told Bjork. I've transmitted news of our success to Admiral Niathor. She'll be sending replacement vehicles immediately.
Good to know.
Bjork stood in the middle of the bridge and turned to look at each officer's display in turn. He was restless, and would continue to be until all those replacement forces were in place.
Your officers look bored.
Bjork gave the Admiral a surprised look.
I don't think so, sir.
Still, let's shake them up a bit. I spent part of yesterday putting together a simulation. In the sim, the three Bothan fleets stage a simultaneous breakout, and one heads straight for Shamanar. There's opportunity for a stand-up fight, or for picking off their weaker units.
Bjork smiled at the Admiral's mistake.
Just telling me that affects my tactics, Admiral.
So it does. Well, put your second-in-command in charge. You and I will run things from the auxiliary bridge.
Right.
Bjork turned toward his second, a tall Gotal.
Lieutenant Syro, you have the bridge for a sim. The Admiral and I will be running it from the auxiliary bridge.
Moments later, Klosken and Bjork walked into the auxiliary bridge, a small, seldom-used chamber, its walls more thickly lined with displays than any other compartment on the frigate. These displays were just now flickering into life, as were the overhead lights. The bridge doors slid shut behind the two men.
All overrides default here, correct?
Klosken asked.
It wouldn't be much use as an emergency bridge if they didn't,
Bjork said.
Oh, sorry, Admiral. I didn't mean to sound sarcastic.
You really ought to watch your mouth, son,
Klosken said. From his pocket, he pulled a holdout blaster. Bjork's eyes widened, as if he thought the Admiral's gesture were a not-too-funny joke about disciplinary measures. Klosken shot him in the chest. Bjork went down on his back, the impact making the floor panels ring. Smoke curled up from the scorched patch on his breastbone, and a little blood oozed from the burned flesh. Using the codes he just heard Bjork use to open and activate the auxiliary bridge, Klosken ensured that the doors could not be opened again. Then he moved to the communications board. He activated a line to the main bridge and said,
Lieutenant Syro, I'm cutting all external communications. From this point on, any communications you make will actually be going to the SIM program. If you get an override message from the fleet, it will be accompanied by a red blink that indicates I'm the real thing. Understood?
Yes, sir.
Klosken punched in controls that would disable all communication antennas aboard the frigate, all but one, which he reserved for use of his own comm board. He moved to the main computer and inserted a data card into its slot. The computer accepted the program and activated it. All over the ship, every internal door or hatch controlled by a servo slid and locked open. Klosken imagined the officers on the bridge staring in puzzlement at the doors as intership communications began buzzing with questions. The door into his bridge remained resolutely shut, of course. It wouldn't do for Klosken to die with the others, though even if he did, his primary mission would still be successful. The main computer display came up with a text message indicating that all safety protocols concerning exterior hatches had been overridden. Klosken nodded. All he had to do now was stand by, though he did have 10 seconds in which he could abort this sequence. He didn't. And when the 10th second counted down, warning lights and chime alarms began to fill the air. Klosken switched the main display from view to view. First was the interior of the frigate's small starfighter bay, where the force field holding the atmosphere had just dissipated. Atmosphere rushed out through the great gaping hole through which starfighters normally launched or landed, and some of the starfighters in the bay rocked slightly. A lone mechanic standing too close to the main opening stumbled, forced along by the air currents fleeing into space, and was swept into the void. Her arms flailed as she drifted out toward explosive decompression and death. The next view showed personnel in the ship's mess. They stood looking around, their eyes wild as they began gulping for air. Some began running for emergency control panels and wall comm boards. Others turned around and around, looking for the source of their trouble. He switched the display to look at the bridge. The holocam view from the bridge was dominated by the face of the human communications officer. He was so close to the holocam that his features were distorted. To either side of him, other bridge officers stood, shouting, clutching their throats. He returned to the comm board and punched in a frequency, then activated it.
Klosken to Koroilin, please respond.
A moment later, the face of a black and tan Bothan appeared on the display.
Kruelin here.
The eye is closed, and Shamanar is ready for a prize crew. She'll be repressurized by the time you get here.
Corellian Exclusion Zone aboard the Errant Venture.
Leia and Luke embraced for a long moment, uncaring that they were surrounded by observers. Those observers were family and friends. And though the private conference room Booster had set aside for his secret guest wasn't exactly as cozy as the vessel's more sumptuous suites, its shortcomings of comfort did not matter. Luke drew away from his sister and followed Mara's lead in shaking hands or offering embraces all around. Han, Lando, Wedge, Corin, Mirax.
"It's good to see you," he said.
The words were simple, but they came from his heart. It startled him to feel this level of relief at seeing people in person when he already knew they were alive and well. But, he supposed, the heart did not always believe what the mind knew to be true.
"Us too,"
Han said, and it was apparent that the distance that had developed between the two men, back when it became clear that Han supported Corellian independence while Luke remained loyal to the Alliance, had finally closed.
"Though we're kind of surprised to see you here."
"We were in the neighborhood," Mara said. "Not a joke. We're in the Corellian system to see if we can pin Jason down, get a few answers from him. Ben is missing."
Leia did not miss the little flash of pain visible in Mara's face, detectable through the Force.
"We don't think Jason knows where he is, but he has some information that might lead us to Ben."
"You've chosen a good time to visit, then," Wedge said. "Jason is here, aboard Errant Venture."
Luke gave him a dubious look.
"Jason? Gambling?"
"No."
Corin shook his head, clearly annoyed.
"He's wandering around, looking things over. Maybe he's come to the same conclusion we did, that Errant Venture is a very useful tool for gathering data. Seems a very GAG thing for him to think of. Or maybe he wants to make sure that the ship doesn't constitute a security leak that would help the Corellians. Either way, he's here, so those of us he knows are having to keep even more out of sight. No more gambling, even in disguise, until he goes away," Han added.
"There's something else," Leia said. "Something I've been sensing through the Force for the last few days. There's a presence aboard ship. Someone or something I can't identify. But it's here, watchful."
"I'll keep that in mind," Luke said.
"You won't be offended if Mara and I go pin Jason with some questions in a few minutes."
Leia shook her head.
"Just be careful. Count on it."
Luke seemed to hesitate before continuing.
"In the meantime, there are some things we need to bring you up to date on. Such as Ali Marar and Lumaya, Dark Lady of the Sith," Mara said. "And now we have a little Force technique developed by Master Silgal that will help us counter the way Alima meddles with memory. We'll teach you."
Jason stopped a few meters from one of the tables in the Maw Casino to watch a microdroid wrestling match. In the duel currently taking place, a droid shaped like a piranha beetle on treads exchanged fire with one shaped like a Tatooine sandcrawler. They were separated by a few meters of artificial terrain, resembling the towering forests of Kashyyyk. But it wasn't the droid fight that drew Jason's attention. It was the woman facing him from the center of the long edge of the table. He knew her face, and he'd never expected to see it again. He circled the table so that it would not be between them and stepped up next to her. Captain Uron Levint looked up from her bedding and her drink to nod at him.
"Colonel Solo?"
"Captain Levint, how did you get here?"
"That's a silly question, isn't it? I got here in the cargo vehicle you gave me."
She lifted her drink, tilted the container toward him in salute, and took a sip.
"Please forgive me for not thanking you before now. The Durakrut has become a good luck charm for me. My fortunes have been improving ever since I took command of her. I've run 3 cargo routes, all at a tremendous profit."
"You haven't had any difficulty with her?"
"Well, she's old. I spent part of your payment to me giving her an overhaul, but nothing catastrophic."
Jason stared down at her, baffled. Jedi could often tell when someone was lying, and Levint was clearly withholding information, but she didn't manifest any of the emotion that should accompany the lies he expected. Then he felt a slight flicker within the Force.
He looked up to see Luke and Mara standing just inside the casino entrance, staring at him. He gave the captain a purely artificial smile.
We'll get caught up later. Looking forward to it. You can buy me a drink.
Pushing Levin from his mind, he approached Luke and Mara, offering each a civil handshake.
Master Skywalker, you should have told me you were coming to Corellia.
Where would you have been if we had?
Mara asked. Jason blinked at the question. Aboard the Anakin Solo, probably. Luke gave him a cheerful smile.
Well, it's nice that we could find you when you have more time for socializing. Let's get a table, order drinks.
Not waiting for a reply, he turned and then led the way into the ranks of small tables closer to the bar. He chose an empty one that appeared to have been recently cleaned. Its glowing, glossy surface was still damp, and sat. Mara and Jason joined him. Jason had to struggle just a bit to keep annoyance from his face. This encounter was inconvenient. Luke leaned in close.
Jason, this is important. We need to know exactly what happened on the asteroid near Bamil.
Jason kept his emotions under tight control and attempted to project nothing more than additional annoyance.
It's true, I haven't had time to write a report. My guard commission came in too soon after our return to Coruscant. Was there something wrong with Ben's report?
Well, it's incomplete, Mara said. It doesn't cover what happened while he was unconscious, or what happened to you while you were separated from him.
Oh, of course.
Jason frowned as if trying to dig up memories, buried beneath tons of more recent events.
Well, let's just concentrate on those two periods then. Brisha Sayo, Nalani, Ben, and I boarded a sort of rail car that took us into the asteroid's interior. A pulse of force energy yanked Ben and Nalani out of the car. After a moment, Brisha was yanked free. The car stopped in a deep cavern, and there I was attacked by a force user who radiated dark side orientation and wore your face, Luke.
Luke nodded. At the same time, I was fighting a force projection with your appearance, an altered appearance, and Mara and Ben were fighting distorted versions of each other.
That's right.
Jason's mind clicked its way through the details Lumaya had so recently provided as he tried to figure out the best order in which to present the information.
My duel ended when the false Luke hurled some boulders at me, and I inverted into a spin with my lightsaber.
We both connected. I took a rock to the head and was out for a while. But when I woke up, my opponent was in two pieces, and once I found his head, several meters away, I could see his true features. A Deveronian. He had no identikit on him. His lightsaber was gone.
Gone?
Mara frowned.
So someone came while you were unconscious and took it.
Jason shrugged as if the detail was of no importance.
Probably it just went flying into a cranny somewhere and I couldn't find it.
It was a very low-gravity environment. You could throw a lightsaber hilt a kilometer if you tried.
And Ben?
Luke asked.
I found him in an upper cavern, Jason said, unconscious. Brisha Sayo was nearby. She'd lost an arm and had sustained a head injury and sucking chest wound, all of them lightsaber inflicted. I stabilized her. She seemed pretty sure her habitat's medical droids would be able to fix her up. She said she found a wicked-looking redhead. Her description matched Ben's evil Mara, preparing to behead Ben, and that she interfered. She was badly wounded but drove the false Mara into retreat.
Luke and Mara exchanged a glance.
So, Luke said, if she was telling the truth, the timing can only work out one way. The Dark Jedi, or whatever he was, impersonated Mara and attacked Ben. He won that fight. Brisha stopped him from killing Ben, and he ran off. Then he took my face and attacked Jason, and Jason killed him.
Mara shook her head.
That doesn't work, though. If we assume there was some link between the two Jason-Luke fights and the two Ben-Mara fights, because my fight with the false Ben and your fight with the false Jason were simultaneous.
Suggesting that my fight with the false Luke and Ben's with the false Mara were too. Jason pretended to puzzle that one over.
The only logical conclusion is that there were two enemies in those caverns, not just one.
That's right.
Luke returned his attention to Jason. He hesitated a moment before continuing.
Jason, we have evidence that Brisha Sayo was Lumaya's daughter.
Jason sat back and allowed a look of startlement to cross his features.
I don't believe it. I'm not that easy to deceive.
She'd be very good at deception, Mara said.
if she were trained by her mother. So, Jason pretended to think it through. So Brisha probably killed Milani, and Brisha dueled Ben. And Ben cut her to ribbons. A little pride crept into Mara's voice with that remark. But she defeated him with some ploy, and she probably did something to him, altering his memories, maybe making him vulnerable to other techniques, just before you came across them. And now, the test of courage, Jason told himself. Do you propose to me that my memories were meddled with too? That my thinking has been altered? Luke seemed to be on the verge of saying something when he looked up and around. A moment later, Jason and Mara felt it too. A massive surge of surprise, consternation, other emotions from another direction joined the mix. Fear, exultation, anger. Those emotions had to be projected by hundreds, even thousands of people simultaneously to manifest like this through the Force. Jason grabbed his comlink and spoke into it. Colonel Solo to the Anakin Solo. Status check.
Sir!
Jason recognized the voice. It belonged to one of the Anakin Solo's communications officers.
It's a fleet action, sir. There's a fleet incoming. They're everywhere. They're already hitting the task force around Corellia proper.
Jason stood and ran toward the door leading from the Maw Casino.
Bridge of the Dodona.
Recall all scouts, shouted Admiral Tara Limpan. Launch squadrons as they come ready. Threat assessment. What are we looking at?
Finally, a hologramic schematic of space directly around the planet Corellia sprang into existence above the bridge walkway. Admiral Limpan was actually within the hologram. She took two steps backward to be clear of it. On the schematic, the sphere of Corellia was a blue wire grid. Alliance ships were small green symbols. Corellian craft on the planet's surface or within her atmosphere were yellow, and unknowns were red. There were lots of unknowns, some of them already streaking down into the atmosphere on the far side of the planet from the Dodona. Far too many were approaching Dodona along orbital vectors. Though Colonel Moyen, her starfighter coordinator, was not on the bridge, he remained in the starfighter control salon, a nearby compartment. His growling voice echoed over the bridge's speaker system.
We have two cruisers, a frigate, and a minimum of 12 starfighter squadrons headed our way. That's only the newcomers. There are at least as many starfighter units rising up from Corellia's surface. This is an all-out push. Our deployments around Centerpoint Station and the other four worlds are reporting similar mismatches.
Limpan looked up toward the high speakers, as though Moyen were up there.
Who are they?
They're Both and assault cruisers, Admiral.
No expression crossed her face, but Limpan felt a twinge of sympathy for Moyen. He was Bothan.
All right, she called. Navigation, plot a course for Centerpoint Station. Order our forces already there to hit the station as hard as they can. Denying it to the Corellians is our top priority. Dodona will join in that action. Where's the Anakin Solo?
Her sensor operator called out.
It was at its usual station, just outside the Saronia orbit, on the direct approach from Coruscant. Now it's coming in. Ask it to join us at Centerpoint.
Limpan could feel the subtle changes in the ship's artificial gravity and see through the viewports at the bow as Dodona slowly wheeled away from her orbit and oriented herself away from the planet's surface.
How many starfighter squadrons do we have on station?
Three, Admiral.
Limpan shook her head rueful. They were going to take a pounding.
Enemy starfighters now reaching our maximum firing range,
Moyen said.
Open fire, Limpan said. The order is fire at will.
Aboard the Errant Venture.
Wedge and Corrin angled into the flag hangar, each skidding as he made the hard turn from the corridor. Their astromechs had done a preliminary power-up, and the canopies of both snub fighters were already open. Wedge was first to his vehicle, but Corrin, rather than climbing the ladder hanging from his cockpit, leapt lightly into his pilot's couch. Wedge swore at the Jedi under his breath and climbed his ladder.
What have we got, sweetie?
Aiella's voice crackled back across his comlink.
Unknown forces hitting every major position held by the Second Fleet in the system. Wait, not unknown. The Centerpoint Station Task Force is reporting Kaminoian markings on the assault forces. The Trilus and Corellian blockade forces are reporting Bothan markings. We have a small force. One frigate and one squadron of fighters headed our way. And the Dodona has ordered Errant Venture not to enter hyperspace until every spaceworthy fighting vehicle aboard is launched.
Wedge swung nimbly into his cockpit. He yanked the ladder free of his fuselage and dropped it to the hangar floor. He slid down into the couch, clamped his helmet on, closed the canopy. Corrin's voice came across his helmet speakers.
Silly operational question. What's our squadron designation?
Wedge snorted. They ought to have one for purposes of coordination and efficiency, but the question just seemed slightly ridiculous under the circumstances.
Ganner. I'm Ganner 1, you're Ganner 2.
He checked his status display.
4 lit, 4 green. Open hangar doors.
Say please,
Ayala said.
Just kidding.
The flag hangar lights dimmed, and the outer doors slid aside.
Wedge and Corrin circled to the length of the Errant Venture, heading toward the stern. They could see starfighters and other vehicles dropping out of the ship's belly bays like explosives dropping from a bomber. The starfighters ignited thrusters, turned toward the world of Corellia, and blasted in that direction. The more distant ones were already leaping forward and vanishing, the visual effect to outsiders of their entering hyperspace. 2 X-Wings from the main hangars came alongside, matching speed and vector. Wedge was startled. They hadn't appeared on his sensor screen until they were a few hundred meters away. But as they drifted into visual range, he saw why. They were stealth X-craft. Their surfaces looked dark and oddly modeled because of the sensor-deafening coatings they wore. Wedge changed his comm frequency to a general military hailing range. He thought he knew the answer, but asked anyway.
Who have we got there?
Hello, Wedge.
Luke, I take it your talk with the Colonel was cut short. Mara's your wing, correct?
Yes. Going to deal with Aaron Venture's pursuit?
Just until the Venture can jump to a safe zone.
Makes sense. You do realize that you're attacking your own allies, don't you?
No one trying to blow up the old man who became my benefactor when I was orphaned is my ally, Luke. By the way, you're now Ganner 3, and Mara's Ganner 4.
There was a short pause.
For Ganner Rhizode?
Luke asked. Rhizode, a Jedi Knight, had died on Coruscant during the Yuuzhan Vong War, fighting and killing more enemy warriors in personal combat than perhaps any other combatant in the war.
Can you think of a better name for someone fighting a delaying action?
No. Who's Ganner 2? Corrin?
Corrin's voice was crisp across the comm channel.
Hello, boss.
Corellian space.
Jason's shuttle was on the verge of entering hyperspace and jumping toward the Anakin Solo's position, just outside the star system on the most direct route toward Coruscant, when he received a new message from the Star Destroyer relaying Admiral Impan's request for assistance at Centerpoint Station. Jason authorized the change in plans, quickly plotted a new jump for Centerpoint, and launched into hyperspace shortly afterward. When he dropped from hyperspace, the Centerpoint engagement was spread out before him. In the background was the station itself, the ugly, cylindrical, kilometers-long mass of it. Nearer were the Galactic Alliance Mon Calamari heavy carrier, Blue Diver, and 2 sturdy-looking Kara-class gunships. Jason stayed well back. The light laser cannon on his shuttle would not add much firepower to the Alliance forces, and he might not be able to detach himself from a skirmish when he needed to. His sensor screen blipped with the arrival of a new force and showed him the blue triangle of the Anakin Solo, just arrived from hyperspace, racing toward the engagement. He heeled over, taking an intercept course that should bring him alongside the Anakin before it reached the engagement and allow him to get aboard before the Anakin had to open up with its weapons batteries, assuming that enemy starfighters didn't rush to engage. He was in luck, though. None of the enemy forces at the station disengaged to meet the Anakin, and Jason reached the command salon within minutes. There, Commander Twizzle, commanding officer of the Anakin Solo, greeted him with a simple nod.
We're preparing to bring the long-range lasers to bear against the gunships.
Belay that, Jason said. Use them to reinforce Blue Diver's fire against the station. Twizzle scowled.
Kill more enemy troops rather than preserve the lives of our own?
Colonel, that's a bad choice under these circumstances.
It's our only choice. Can't you see what's going on? Admiral Impan wouldn't have ordered the attack on the station if she weren't sure that the enemy forces could drive us out of the system. And if we are driven out and leave an intact Centerpoint station behind...
Yes, Colonel. Twizzle didn't sound convinced, but turned to the weapons officer.
Take a new target. Centerpoint station. Continuous fire. Inflict as much damage as possible.
Corellian space.
Luke had to agree that Wedge's improvised plan was a good one, or would be if it worked. But then he decided that was true of all plans. In retrospect, they were only as good as they were successful, regardless of how brilliant they might have appeared before execution. He and Mara were many kilometers out ahead of Wedge and Corrin,
and a few kilometers to one side of the straight-line approach the enemy force was taking. As soon as their sensors detected the incoming frigate, he and Mara shut down all active systems and went dead in space, merely drifting. From this point, until they rejoined Wedge and Corrin, they would not use their comm systems. Their force bond, undetectable by sensors, would be their only means of communication. Passive sensors showed Wedge and Corrin approaching the enemy force, showed the enemy starfighters arraying themselves out in front of the frigate as a defensive screen. Luke nodded. These were wise, basic tactics. The frigate and starfighter screen passed Luke and Mara's position, and Luke's sensor showed the frigate to be an axe-shaped Nebulon B. The Jedi waited there and watched the battle begin. Wedge and Corrin, staying so close to each other that they were sometimes one blip on the sensors, darted to one edge of the starfighter screen. There was a swirl of activity there, and suddenly, Wedge and Corrin were in retreat. 11 enemy starfighters remained, and one was dead in space, its pilot requesting shuttle pickup over comm frequencies. Luke gave Mara a simple prod through the force, then lit his thrusters and began to maneuver in behind the frigate. She tucked in beside him, and he could feel a cool readiness flow from her, a dispassionate willingness to inflict damage, kill, even die as necessary. Their approach was smooth and slow, designed to benefit from these X-Wing's comparative invisibility to sensors. They needed to come as close as possible and launch their proton torpedoes before the frigate's crew realized they were there. At the moment, the frigate was running with its shields most powerful at the bow, weaker at the stern. A sensible measure, as Wedge and Corrin were keeping the starfighter skirmish out ahead of the frigate. Closer they came, now 100 kilometers behind the frigate, now 90. When they were so close that their attacks would take less than a second to reach the frigate, but not so close that retaliatory laser fire would be at point-blank range, Luke fired a torpedo. A split second later, Mara fired hers. Luke activated his X-Wing shields and through their force bond, felt Mara do the same. The torpedo thrusters drew a near instantaneous straight line to the frigate's stern. Luke's torpedo detonated against its rear shields. Then Mara's disappeared into the blast zone and detonated as well. It took a few moments for the superheated gases of the explosions to dissipate. As they cleared, they revealed a frigate's stern that was badly damaged, deeply cratered. Luke couldn't see a single functioning thruster. He gave a little whoop. One enemy was out of commission, and the loss of life had to have been low. If luck was with the frigate, it might have lost no personnel at all. Luke and Mara accelerated in an arc toward the starfighter engagement. Sensors now showed 8 activities in the engagement zone. Wedge, Corrin, and 6 hostiles. On Luke's sensor screen, the computer finally identified the hostiles. I-7 Howl Runners. The Stealth X fighters were only a few kilometers from the engagement zone when the 5 still functional Howl Runners broke away, roaring back toward the frigate. Luke and Mara let them go. The Howl Runners took up position circling the crippled frigate, a far more pathetic defensive screen than they had been mere minutes before. Luke reactivated his comm transmitter. What now?
Back to the Errant Venture for me, Wedge said. To give protection until it makes the jump into hyperspace. I'm not going to get involved in the main battle. Honestly, I wouldn't know whose side to be on.
Mara asked.
How about you, Corrin?
Corrin sounded just a little uncertain.
It's kind of up to you, Luke. I've tended to all my personal business on Corellia. I don't need to go back. Where do you need me?
Coruscant, Luke answered instantly. We need all the good sense and sharp thinking we can get at the temple. But for now, Mara and I will be heading to the main engagement to see what good we can do for the Alliance forces. You want to come along or head back to the temple?
I'll fight.
Wedge said.
Luke, you're Ganner 1 now. Best of luck.
Likewise. As Wedge peeled off from their formation and set a course for the Errant Venture, Luke opened up his comm board to listen across military frequencies to find out what was happening and where.
Aboard the Dodona.
Admiral Impan retreated to the command salon, which was smaller, quieter, and less frantic than the bridge. Now she could hear herself think again and could more easily track the battle's progress. And Dodona's probable death. The Galactic-class battle carrier, commissioned less than a year before, was being chewed to pieces by the Bothan forces pursuing her. She might not last long enough to flee the solar system. The constant pounding by the laser batteries of enemy cruisers, and just as damaging, the missiles and torpedoes of enemy starfighters, was taking a terrible toll on Limpan's flagship.
"Ready to enter hyperspace, Admiral," her navigator announced.
"Launch," she said.
The exterior view, brought in by the salon's displays, showed the stars twist, become streaks of light, and then instantly revert to stars again, because this hyperspace jump was very short, not even leaving the system. Centerpoint Station and the furious fight being waged around it appeared on the main display.
Navigation, Limpan said. Plot a course to send us on an approach close to the station, at optimal range for our batteries. We'll make one pass and pour as much damage as we can into her. Then we're outbound. Our next jump will take us to... Fenn, what's the designation for the muster point you use for your initial assault on the system?
Colonel Fiev Fenn, a female Sulliston, turned from her station computer.
Point Bleak, she said.
Fenn had been the aide to Limpan's predecessor, Admiral Kloskin. Limpan had her own aide, but had transferred Fenn to starfighter coordination duty and was pleased with her work in that role.
Once we're past center point,
if we survive, Limpan thought,
our next jump will take us to Point Bleak. Communicate with all other Alliance forces. Tell them to break off the engagement and join us there. Tell Errant Venture they have the option of joining us there also.
Limpan settled into her command chair and scowled at the main display. Scowled at Fenn's back. The chair vibrated beneath her as Dodonna sustained another torpedo hit. More red lights flashed on the diagnostic displays. More quietly, Limpan added,
communications. Let Blue Diver know that as soon as we reach Point Bleak, she's to come alongside. I'll be transferring the flag to Blue Diver.
Yes, ma'am.
Dodonna poured damage down onto Centerpoint Station, digging a latitudinal trench of melted metal and scoring to match the longitudinal one Blue Diver had gouged. But the pursuing Bothan and Corellian starfighters, unchecked by a sufficient starfighter screen, continued to hammer away at the battle carrier. Blue Diver broke away from the station to follow the flagship, using her batteries to eliminate as much of the starfighter pursuit as she could. But it was like a novice Jedi trying to protect a haunch of blood-warm meat from a swarm of piranha beetles. Finally, Dodonna jumped, joined shortly thereafter by Blue Diver and the hyperdrive-equipped starfighter supporting them. Anakin Solo was the last to enter hyperspace. Arriving at Point Bleak, the three capital ships maneuvered close to one another, the better to exchange aid and support with overlapping fields of heavy weapons fire. But no enemy vessels followed them out of hyperspace. They had time to assess damage, to communicate with Coruscant, to gather data. It wasn't long before the holonet churned with news reports from Corellia. Prime Minister Durgedjian almost glowed with the victory of casting free the yoke of Galactic Alliance oppression, and offered praise to the forces of Bothawee and Commonor, and to his own battle coordinator, Admiral Delphin, who was conspicuously commended for doing what Admiral Antilles could not, as if she'd had any role in bringing the Bothans and Commonorians to the table. Admiral Nyathal ordered Dodonna back to Coruscant. She ordered Limpan's task force to effect repairs, stand by, and use its resources to monitor activity within the Corellian system. She also warned Limpan of possible treachery or sabotage. It was clear that the Bothan fleet's departure from the Bothawee system had been kept secret, owing to some catastrophic failure of the Alliance forces monitoring that system. Within a day, the Galactic Alliance declared that the state of war previously enacted against Corellia now extended to Bothawee and Commonor as well. Holonews political analysts, sober or gleeful depending on the political and exploitative leanings of their own news services, speculated on which systems would be next to join what they now referred to as the Corellian Confederation. Commendations were offered on both sides. Memorial services for the dead took place. And with the political climate changed, with a negotiated peace between an isolated Corellia and the Alliance no longer possible, Jason Solo and the Anakin Solo were ordered back to Coruscant.
Zyost.
From high orbit, the world of Zyost didn't look like a place of evil. It was a typical blue-green world, a good mix of landmass and open water, ice at the poles, white cloud formations everywhere, including the characteristic spiral of a hurricane over one of the oceans. The landmasses at the equator seemed to be almost entirely green, graduating to green-white up through the temperate zones and turning to pure white soon after, giving the world large polar ice caps. There was no hint of desert or any terrain other than forest and tundra. It was, in fact, a beautiful place, if one looked only with one's eyes. But Ben had other senses, and through the Force he could feel something else, something malevolent about the planet. It seemed to be staring at him, as if it were a mottled eye belonging to a hideous, hate-filled face he couldn't quite make out. Ben stared at Xyost, and Xyost stared at Ben. Ben gulped.
Shaker, do you pick up any thruster trails?
Ben asked the R2 unit that came with the Y-Wing starfighter he had appropriated. The astromech tweedled an affirmative noise, and lines of text popped up on one of the Y-Wing's cockpit displays. Heavy orbital trail indicates one or more vehicles in specific orbit for considerable time. Vehicles left orbit approximately 8 standard hours ago and made planetary descent. The cockpit sensor display switched from a live sensor feed to a diagram of the planet's surface, with dotted lines showing the abandoned orbit and the descent path. Ben felt a wash of relief. Of course, Xyost was a dead world in terms of planetary civilization. Few vehicles ever arrived here, and thruster trails would be distinct for a long time. That changed the prospect of finding a single vehicle in an area the size of a planetary surface from crazy to possible. He switched the R2 unit's data over to his navigation computer and plotted his own descent. From an altitude of a few kilometers, traveling slowly enough that the Y-Wing would neither cause sonic booms nor pull contrails visible from the ground, Ben studied the vehicle that must have brought Faskus back to Xyost. It was a Corellian YT-2400 light transport, disc-shaped, like Uncle Han's venerable Millennium Falcon, but with its cockpit at the end of a starboard side outrigger-style projection. At least it had once been a YT-2400. Now it was a scorched heap of buckled durasteel, blackened in numerous places by fire, smoke still curled up into the sky from spots where the hull had ruptured. The cockpit and its access tube had separated from the transport's main body and had rolled or been hurled down a gentle incline, putting them 20 meters from the main hull. A light snowfall drifted down across the two main portions of the destroyed craft. Had it crash-landed? Ben increased the magnification on his visual display and shook his head. No. The scorch patterns on portions of the hull showed clear sign of turbo laser strafing. The transport had been fired upon multiple times and then had burned. Ben quickly switched back to primary sensors, but there was no sign of other air traffic in this area. The attacker was long gone. Ben spiraled down to a landing in the same clearing Faskus had chosen. He set the Y-Wing down well clear of the burned wreckage, then investigated on foot. Portions of the transport were cool enough to approach, and he was even able to enter one or two places where hatches had been blown off or the hull had gaped open wide enough to admit him. There was nothing within but lingering smoke and the smell of burned plastics and pseudo-leathers. Seeking more clues, he opened himself up to the Force and shivered. The sensation of being stared at was stronger here than it had been in orbit. And then he felt it, just at the periphery of his Force senses, a little hint of wicked glee, just as he'd felt it at the display case on Drua. Heading westward, the direction in which Ben felt the distant glee, he and Shaker plunged into the forest of Xyost. It was a cold day. Though Ben had felt comfortable out in the clearing, in the cloud-muted sunlight, here the forest canopy cut off most of the sunlight, and Ben felt a chill. The massive, dark, twisting tree trunks, looking like pain-racked bodies, flash-frozen and preserved in their agonies, added to his unease. He pulled his Jedi cloak from his backpack and donned it, grateful for both its warmth and the symbolic protection it offered. There were no trails through this forest, just dense undergrowth. Shaker's limitations in the environment, the droid could move briskly on its wheels on flat, hard surfaces, but had to waddle slowly on legs on uneven terrain, kept their progress slow. But in the first hour of travel, Ben did not feel the glee he was pursuing become more distant. If anything, he and Shaker seemed to be closing, very slowly, on his quarry. Then he heard sounds from the direction they'd come. The sounds were far away, muffled by distance in the oppressive forest, but Ben thought he recognized the scream of ion engines, the thoom of laser fire.